no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a
off. He's listening to you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging. Mostly because there's no grass on the golf course. But there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag. I have the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is going on, folks? Welcome back to episode 73 of the Beltway Golfer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. For this show, we've got a local golf teacher that I've wanted on the show for some time. She has a huge social media following. And if you're on the internet, if you're on social media, it seems to be kind of everywhere. And she recently just got included in Golf Magazine's top 100 golf teachers in the country, Miss Trillium Rose, who is the director of instruction at Woodmont Country Club in Rockville. And having her on this week, the release of this podcast coming on Solheim Cup weekend seems appropriate. Quite frankly, haven't had enough women in golf around the DC area on the show. I plan to rectify that. Had some, but not enough. So it's good to have Trillium on. We had a great conversation. Really enjoyed chatting with her. It was the first time that we had met, first time that we'd ever spoken, but she was great. And she's obviously extremely talented at what she does. Before we get to that conversation, a couple things to bring up. One, we're getting down to the wire. Our event next month at Mount Vernon Country Club, October 23rd. It's a Monday. The Silver Dollar Shootout. If you're not familiar with it, go check out our website at beltwaygolfer.com. Go to our social media. It's on most of them, but certainly Instagram at Beltway Golfer. But this is going to be a fun event. We're going to have tea gifts for everybody. I've got some cool things putting together, including a really cool kind of ball marker, a Silver Dollar Shootout kind of replica of a Silver Dollar. That's going to be kind of neat. We got prizes. We're going to have a charity auction where you can bid on a bunch of different stuff, including rounds at golf courses, including the Omni Homestead, or the Cascades course, or the old course. Laurel Hill, Fairfax County is donating a foursome at every single one of their courses that people are going to bid at this tournament. The private cut along at Lake Anna, which we did a podcast with their architect, Tom Clark, down just an hour and a half or so south of DC. That's going to be up for bid. Got a bunch of stuff coming along. Still putting everything together, but it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be 11 a.m. shotgun start. It's a two-person better ball, lighthearted competition. We're going to have prizes for both net and gross winners, but this is about fun. It's going to be a Monday. We're going to have drinks. We got Four Craft Cocktails has already agreed to hook up some drinks. I'm working on a beer sponsor as well. But it's going to be a good time. We've got spots available. Deadline to register is Monday, October 9th. Spots are available. Would love to have you out. Looking to sell this out. So again, it's the Silver Dollar Shootout, Monday, October 23rd at Mount Vernon Country Club in Alexandria. And before I move on, a couple people asked me kind of why am I doing this? Why am I starting to get into events? Quite frankly, I'm a public golfer. I don't belong to a country club. There are so many country clubs around the Washington, D.C. area. The followers and listeners of this podcast and followers of Beltway Golfer on social are a mix of public golfers and folks that belong to clubs. The purpose of these tournaments is not just as a way to kind of build relationships and meet folks that either have been following along, people that we've communicated with over the years through Beltway Golfer, but it's just to give public golfers the opportunity to play their own ball at a private country club that maybe they're not getting that invite to. You know, a lot of these clubs do host charity tournaments, but they're always scrambles. You know, you're not really playing your own ball. You're playing a captain's choice kind of thing. Those are fun, but it's not quite the same. So want to kind of put together a series of these primarily at private clubs, not because, we're private club dudes, but more to give just an opportunity for people to play these courses that, you know, they may not otherwise. And we're going to have fun. It's going to be a fun day. So go to beltwaygolfer.com, the Silver Dollar Shootout, click on outings, and would love to have you out. And if you're listening to this and want to sponsor the event, or you work somewhere that you run a company or work at a company that might want to both participate in the event and sponsor and get you in front of 72 local diehard golfers, reach out. shoot me a message on social media or send an email to interloop@beltwaygolfer.com. Hope to hear from you. Moving on, word from our sponsor, Union Green. We are still sponsored by Union Green. We love Union Green. I've been playing their pin drop golf ball for most of the summer now. I'm a fan. I love it. Got rocking my Union Green t-shirt right now. They've got a special at uniongreen.com where you buy any two pieces of apparel, and that includes hats, they'll send you a free dozen of their T-Bird golf balls, which is their distance ball. Go check them out. They're all about playing local, playing municipal golf, playing public golf. Their messaging and their vibe is what we're all about. Proud to have them as a sponsor. And guess what? I enjoy their product. I've been using their ball for a while now, and I really like it. So follow them on socials at Golf Union Green. Go to uniongreen.com. Take advantage of that special and get yourself a free dozen golf balls. But thank you to Union Green for sponsoring the show. And of course, by supporting Union Green, you're supporting the show. Head over to union.com. That's kind of it for an intro. I'm going to keep it short and get right to our conversation with Trillium Rose. Trillium's really a brand unto herself. Go to her website. She sells beginner coaching packages, almost like a masterclass kind of thing where you can prepay for a whole series of instructional videos. She's got a little bit of everything, but she's got an interesting story because she gets into it, but she's, you know, her background, she wasn't a diehard golfer growing up. Anyway, I'll stop rambling and we'll get to the conversation. Here it is, episode 73 with Trillium Rose of Woodmont Country Club. Hope you enjoy. I want to start off by congratulating you. I know this wasn't the first time, but you recently just got named to Golf Magazine's top 100 golf teachers, and Golf Digest already named you top 50. So, I mean, it's just top 100, top 50, which magazine? What do, obviously it's a great honor, but like when you get named for that, what's kind of like, what's your reaction?
Thanks, Alex. I mean, obviously it's a huge honor, right? We know how many people are named to that list because it's in the name of the list, 50. So 50 people with Golf Digest and 100 people with Golf Magazine. So I counted on the most recent 100 list for Golf Magazine, how many people I knew. I knew 36 of those people. Enough that I have them in my phone and I can just call them. So it's a really diverse group, and it's an impressive group. And we were just talking about how many different areas of expertise there are within the game. And I think the group covers a very wide spectrum of that. So it's fun to be recognized. Of course, I think it's also fun to have an opportunity to have a platform to speak to people, because at the end of the day, really what I love the most is helping people. I love it. And that gives me a bigger audience to really speak to.
That's interesting. Do you think that's about average among like PGA professionals, like knowing, so that's, we'll call it a third of your fellow professionals on that list? It seems to be, there's so many events, seemingly, obviously I'm not one, but amongst the PGA professionals of America, different sections of Mid-Atlantic PGA, that it seems to be very social in a lot of ways to get to know your fellow pros. Like how 36 different of the top 100, like how have you met most of them?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. There are a lot of continuing education events, conferences, seminars, educational opportunities. And so the PGA of America is I'm sure all your listeners know this. It's the largest sports organization in the world with 26,000 members in the United States and globally, but mostly that's just the United States. So there's 26,000 PGA members. Those would be the people that have a logo next to their name. You go into a golf course, you walk into the golf shop, there's going to be a PGA member or an apprentice that's on their way to being a member. PGA of America has a lot of money. They run the Ryder Cup and the PGA Championship, and they can support the members. So each of the sections, so the country is divided into 41 geographical sections, and each mm-hmm. section has its own kind of governing body with an executive director. And there's a kind of governing process. So the Middle Atlantic is our section. We've got a very strong section of talent and people, and, you know, so we'll have our own teaching summit. So this is kind of a long way of saying each of the 41 sections has their own teaching summits. So, you know, I've keynoted other teaching summits in different sections. So you kind of get to know each other. You get to know who's out there, what they're talking about, what their expertise is, what they have to offer, why are they on stage? They might bring some different perspectives. And really a lot of times golf pros are on this little island. You know, we're in our own golf course, in our own facility. We don't get to talk to other pros very often. So it's really nice to be able to share ideas and to kind of help each other out. And I think that's one of the best things about this industry is there is so much knowledge sharing.
Yeah. And speaking of that, so the executive director of the Mid-Atlantic PGA was actually on the show, John Gould, about a year and a half ago, where he taught me a lot of what you just said, which is kind of the ins and outs of, you know, the function of each section of the PGA of America, which a lot of which I truthfully didn't know. But this week there's a big event. It's the sectional championship up at Baltimore Country Club. And I was just this morning, I was kind of looking through the pairings of the tee times at the sectional championship. And it's like who's who of local professionals representing like every club. Have you ever gone up to that? Do you participate in some of the sectional playing events?
I used to a lot when I was, and not so much as a mom and not so much with, just have taken on a lot of other things that I've been doing. So I haven't done it as much. There was definitely a kind of an ebb and flow in my playing where one year I just decided I'm going to play 9 holes every day after work at 6 o'clock. I'm going to play 9 holes. This is before I was married with kids. And that kind of re-energized my love for playing. And then, just things kind of changed. I also am really competitive and I don't like to play badly. So if I'm going to play, I'm going to really play. And that makes, so I'll put in time to practice and get my game really tuned in. And then there'll be times where I'm like, I'm not ready to grind it up. But I say most pros, and I'm included, most pros, I mean, we have good enough games that we could just kind of go in and just play decently. So that's one of the nice things about being a golf pro is that your game never kind of gets rusty.
Sure. I imagine being, you mentioned being a mom, that's got to change. That changes your schedule dramatically. How old? I've got a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old. How old are your kids?
Yeah, we have one. She's 6.
She's 6. Oh, wow. Yeah, congrats. That's fun age. So how has that? I mean, so there's no more 9 holes after you're done teaching. It's right home.
No, I'm just fitting it in when I can. So I'll play. I'm a nighter now. I play 9 holes. So I'll play with some girlfriends on Monday afternoons and I'll play 9 holes when it starts to slow down. Like now is a great time to jump out and get some holes in. 3 holes there, 5 holes here, just swinging a club is good.
I hear you. I'm kind of the same. The rounds of 18 that I get in a year have dramatically decreased, but I think I'm still playing kind of the same amount of golf, but there's a lot of unfinished rounds because the phone starts blowing up or you just know that the window is short from the get-go. So either play 9 or just a few holes whenever you can. So one thing I want to ask you, there's another big event this week that we'll get into in a minute. I want to talk about Solheim, but you just went on a fun following your social media. You just went on a fun, I'm assuming it was a road trip. I don't know because of your stops, but you hit the US Open, you hit the US Mid-Am, you hit the Women's Mid-Am. Can you tell us about your recent trip and kind of the stops you made?
Yeah. Very observant, Alex. Very observant. That was a crazy 2 days because the Woodmont, where I teach, Woodmont Country Club in Rockville, we've hosted the Women's Am. That was in 2020. It was the first championship that the USGA held during COVID. So it's this, let's see what happens. This is before the vaccine, everyone's testing. I mean, it was just crazy. We couldn't let anybody in to see the tournament, even though it was outdoors. I mean, it was hard, but we really, really wanted to do it again. So we are going to host the Adaptive. So the very first one was in Pinehurst, if you remember.
Oh, really? Yeah, sure.
So we're going to have that at Woodmont. And because of that.
Is that what year? Is that like soon?
In 2 years.
Oh, cool. I don't think I heard that.
So because of this, because we want to host and we want to do the best job we can with USJ events, we as in Woodmont will send someone to just go to all these sites and see how they've set it up. Get some ideas, just get a sense of what the standard is at you know, today, if it's done anything differently than we would have done or we have done. Or, so it's just good. So I went to the first, I went to Stonewall. Stonewall is a Tom Doak golf course, built in the 90s. I think it's recognized in the top 100 golf courses recently. There are two courses and they're playing on one of the golf courses. It really is. It's an Amish country. You have to drive. I mean, mostly. And while I was there, by the way, do you remember that convict that escaped from prison?
Yes. Yeah. A buddy of mine showed me the, where he like scaled the wall, like, like Spider-Man style.
It was loose in the area where we were. So what, you know, there were cops every stoplight. I mean, there must've been 85 police and state police. That was sort of crazy. I don't think the tournament players knew. Anyway, so that was really fabulous to see the golf course and to see what was going on there. Then Woodmont's director of rackets, Bruce Bislipka, tennis pro. He coaches a team that made it to the finals of the US Open, doubles team. So that was happening. The finals was happening that Sunday, and I was at Stonewall Sunday. And so I thought, wait a sec, I'm going to be in New York that night at a dinner meeting. Why don't I go? So I went to the finals and they won. They won.
How cool is that?
It was so cool. So that was cool.
Was that your first US Open tennis?
I lived in New York City as when I first graduated college. I lived in New York for 6 years. So I actually have been to the US Open, but never in the Arshad Stadium and never for a finals. So that was pretty awesome to see that. And then that night, then I went overnight. And then the next day I went to Sleepy Hollow where I used to teach. And I watched the men. And well, actually, let me put it this way. There was a rain delay. So the qualifying rounds had been pushed. So there was a stretch of time where there was no one on the golf course. So
I thought,
this is a perfect opportunity for me to walk it because I hadn't seen it since it had been redone by Gil Hands. That was in 2010-11 after I left.
Dramatically different. I mean, and now it's like one of the most Instagrammable golf courses, especially number 16 you see on Instagram like every 2 seconds.
It's a C.B. McDonald golf course. So C.B. McDonald, and not that many that are, I mean, I think there's five or six, like St. Louis Golf Club, there's Chicago, there's Mid-Ocean. I mean, there's a few C.B. McDonald golf courses, National Golf Links, of course, the one we all know. I think of this as if we use a classic car as a metaphor, like a 1962 Jaguar convertible coupe that just hadn't been kept up. It is sitting in your grandmother's driveway. A beautiful car. You're not going to dramatically change that. If you are, you're nuts. What you want to do is get it in running shape. You want to kind of fix the leather. You want to maybe replace a couple filters. You want to get the tires all set. You want to oil the thing up, get the fluids in there so that it can actually run, maybe retouch the paint a bit. So that's what Gil Hands did. And what ended up happening is, with Sleepy, is there's a man named George Votto who had since passed away. George was a self-proclaimed expert in golf course design. And he was obsessed with C.B. McDonald. He ended up writing this beautiful coffee table book that didn't make very many prints called The Evangelist of Golf.
Okay.
And someone had found these old pictures. Someone had come up, a member found these old pictures of Sleepy in their attic, and he had done a lot of research. So anyway, so Gil and George met, and they kind of looked at all these things, and the golf committee at Sleepy and the people that really cherished this beautiful gem of a golf course said, why don't we just restore the course. Let's make this what it was. And let's study it and honor it and bring it back to what it could possibly be and kind of modernize slightly. And, you know, trees grow, and when trees grow, they kind of create changes in how that golf course would look. And over time, if your mowing lines change, your fairways start to change, you know, this stuff settles. Yeah. So anyway, so that's what the course is. And I never walked it. And so I love golf course design. So I spent 2 hours just walking it by myself, 1 through 18, and it was fabulous.
Oh, that's really cool. Did you get a chance to see any of the action, or the rain delay kind of caused you to
no
not
action.
See much? Okay.
It was actually, it worked out okay with me.
That's it. Well, what's funny is about, I mean, this, we were talking about this even before we started recording about social media and just kind of the tricks of it all. But when you're viewing somebody else, you know, you just said a 2 day trip. As a viewer, it looked like you were on the road for a week. Just looking at some picture posts, sometimes it's always hard to tell when you're just kind of watching along, but that's cool. So that gives you an opportunity to talking about, you know, you're the pro at Sleepy Hollow. I heard in another podcast, you are a New England girl, right? Vermont?
Yeah.
So yeah. Can you walk us through a little bit, just kind of your, like how you became a pro and then kind of what clubs you worked up leading up to Woodmont?
Yeah, that's okay. I'll give you the quick story.
Okay.
So I'm from, Vermont. Vermont is a pretty short little window of warm weather. I mean, 5 months, maybe if you're okay with 50 degrees, then you can probably stretch that out a little bit with patches of snow sitting on the fairway with kind of mud. We call it mud season in Vermont because when the snow melts, it gets really soft. So it's not a good time to play golf, but the fall and kind of in, but then the leaves are everywhere. So if you've played golf anywhere that in the fall, you know, it's really a pain in the butt to try to find your ball and leaves. So, I mean, from those two standpoints, the season really is not that, right? It's not that long. So I played ice hockey and I played not very well. I mean, we had a pond, so I skated. I didn't play organized hockey. My brother did, but I played a lot of different sports growing up, gymnastics and skiing. So I love sports. I love competition. Loved competition and loved points in general. When I went to high school, there was no golf team. I went to boarding school. So I thought, well, I can play golf when I retire. Why don't I just pick up another sport that would be fun, like a team. I love team sports. So I picked up lacrosse. So lacrosse was fun and I loved it. And golf was kind of a summer sport for me, where I played in some tournaments, but it wasn't that, you know, I never thought I would be a college golfer or anything beyond, you know, just a recreational golfer, but I loved it. Then in college, I played on the U.S. All-Star team. I played on Southern California's national team. I played on another showcase team, the North-South team. So lacrosse was really, I was very focused and I loved it. And then when I kind of had to think about career stuff, I was a media studies major. And if I hadn't been in golf, I'd probably be a producer, honestly, right now. I've been working for a movie director as her assistant, you know, other productions with her on set, and then post-production at Warner Brothers Studios with one of her projects. So
that's a product of going to school in Southern California or and being close to LA and Hollywood.
It was intentional. I mean, I went to school in LA because I really liked the movie industry, movie and photography. I was doing a lot of photography, still photography. So that I kind of knew I wanted to be in New York City. So I figured if I go to LA for this, I would have a community and network and meet people. And then I'd always feel comfortable going back to LA, but I could live in New York. So when I moved back to New York, I picked up another job working for a producer and part-time at Saturday Night Live, working on the film unit as their fourth assistant, because they'll get a script.
You worked at Saturday Night Live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
That was pretty fun. So that was in 2001, 2003, kind of Will Ferrell, Jimmy Fallon, Tina Fey era. And, you know, you get a script. We'd get a script on Wednesday or Thursday. You'd have to turn that around pretty quickly and then produce it. Like, so you'd have to get permits if you're going to film on the street. You got to get whatever you need for whatever it is. And these were usually the commercials, like the not live commercial stuff.
Sure.
Pretty good big budget for that, like $20,000-$30,000 to turn a commercial around. So these were pretty substantial shoots that we could get done in a day and a half, and then be ready to roll and have it done by Friday, ready to roll by Saturday.
Can you think of like what's the most famous or well known commercial skit that you worked on during that time?
Some of these are just silly. I mean, they're all silly, but. I can't. No pressure.
No, that's diapers.
Yeah, it actually happened even so funny because having worked on the production side, it's sometimes I wasn't even really focused on what we were doing as much as really making it work from behind the scenes.
But those commercials for a long time, I don't even know if they still do the commercials, quite frankly, but for a long time, that was like the funniest bit of the show.
Yay. That is funny to hear that. And there are some older ones too. Like, remember the Bass-O-Matic with Rosanna Dana?
Absolutely. It's hysterical.
So anyway, that was my mindset at the time. Right. And, and then my dad randomly had a stroke, which he lived, but he had like very, very scary and severe paralysis at the time, you know, given his last rites and stuff. And my friend was getting married. So I had a reason to go back to Vermont from New York. So I went back to Vermont. And while I was there for a few days, I played golf. And the head pro at the time said to me, Trill, my assistant just left. He's left. It's August. Why don't you be my assistant? And what do you mean by your assistant in golf? I didn't even know what that meant. Because I played, but I didn't know what the business of golf was. And I said, I don't even know what that means. And he's like, don't worry. I'll show you. So I initially said no. And then I thought about it. I thought, you know, maybe it took me a day. And I think, well, maybe this is a little omen and I should just stay home and be around home. Cause I'd been to boarding school since I was 14. So I hadn't really spent that much time at home especially not as an adult, a young adult. So I took it. So I left New York. I figured I would just run the rest of the summer out up there. And then I would go back to New York because I could kind of pick up what I was doing again.
Sure.
That is not what happened. What happened is I ended up staying at this golf course. We'd look out the window at the driving range and there'd be a bunch of ladies hitting. And John would say, why don't you go help him, give him a clinic? I'd say, what are you talking about? I don't know how to teach. I know how to play, but I don't know how to teach. He's like, doesn't matter. Like, had he not been so loose about the whole thing, I wouldn't be a golf pro today. For sure not. I wouldn't.
That's great. I mean, that's great. It's tremendous advice. It's kind of just jump in, figure it out, you know, feet to the fire, throw you to the wolves and you'll figure it out.
That's right. I just jumped in. I jumped in, feet to the fire, throw me to the wolves. And it was the most, I would say, untethered time in my life where I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how, where to go. So I had to quickly learn about the industry. What did this mean for me? What did I want to be? I had never had a female golf pro in my life. I didn't even really know about golf pros because my dad taught me how to play. And there was no junior program. I just played with my brother and my dad. So my sense of what I could do in this business was very, very murky. And it was also because of this pro at the time who said to me, well, I had asked him, what now? What? It's going to snow. What do you do? And he said, well, golf pros just go to Florida. Okay. What do we do in Florida? I was like, don't worry. I'll help you get a job. So he made a few phone calls to some people he knew. And I didn't have a resume in golf at all. My resume was all media stuff. You know, my references were all media references. It was like totally out of the, and granted, it was only 3 years out of college. It's not like I was 15 years in a business and making a total change. I was still pretty young. I was like 22, still really young. Okay. So he called down this was Orchid Island, and they didn't have any assistant jobs in the shop, but they had an outside ops job, which I didn't even know what the difference was. So I took it. So I went down there, worked outside ops, and it was really funny because I was the youngest by far. Now in Florida, a lot of the guys that work outside are retired and they're just looking to have a couple tea times a week. So sure. These were all ex-military, 50 years and up, like retired guys.
Which club is this or what area?
Or Orchid Island in,
I don't even know where that is.
Arnold Palmer Design in Vero Beach, Florida on the East Coast.
Got it. That's where the Dodgers used to have spring training there.
That's exactly right. I think they still, but they certainly, okay. I went to watch on their spring training. So that was that was that it was kind of cool. It was I mean, so many stories along this ridiculous sort of pivot. But I met a guy who lived in my hallway in this apartment, and he was a real chatty Cathy, and he was an assistant at a neighboring club, and he just was so helpful in giving me some ideas about where to be, things like, it doesn't matter where you work, the golf course wise, it's who you work for. And I think that was good advice, probably even for anybody. So you want to work for a good head pro. And from there, I knew he was working for a guy at a neighboring club, and the guy was Steve Archer. And Steve Archer had worked for Bob Ford. And Bob Ford was the head pro of Oakmont and Seminole. And at the time, Golf Digest ran a piece on the 10 most influential people in golf, Tiger Woods being number one, Bob Ford was number four. So anybody that worked for Bob Ford was kind of walking on water, and then they got really good jobs. So I called Steve Archer, cold called him, and said, you certainly don't know me. I know you. Would you be willing to talk to me for 15 minutes? I would love to just pick your brain and learn a little bit. So he said, sure, when do you want to come tomorrow? So I went over, and a 45-minute conversation. He asked me all kinds of questions, like, what would you do if you couldn't? Okay, what would you do if you couldn't fail? Don't answer that now, but come back to me. He asked me all these questions. The top 10 things you do if you couldn't fail, and all this stuff. And so I went back to him a week later. I had all my answers, da-da-da. So it was a great opportunity. Then that same neighbor of mine was at Sleepy Hollow. And he said, I work for Dave Young. Dave Young doesn't really go off of resumes. He likes to meet you in person. That's how he hires people. He does it in person, and you have to go play golf with them. And I said, great. That's great, because my resume is thin, but I can play golf, and I'd love to meet him, and I like people. So that was my winter, right? I had no plan after the winter in Florida. So my neighbor then left. I interviewed with Dave Young at Sleepy. I got the job. So then in the spring, I went up to Sleepy Hollow. Then midway through Sleepy Hollow, I got a call from Steve Archer, and he said, hey, I'm looking to hire. Would you want to work for me? And I was like, yes. So that's how I started. So I did Sleepy Hollow, Quail Valley, Sleepy Hollow, Quail Valley, Sleepy Hollow, right? And so that's how I kind of got the momentum going. Yep. So for 10 years, I went north, south, north, south to a variety of different places. And then at one point, I realized I really wanted to teach. Teaching was really something I loved. And Kevin Sprecher was the director of instruction at Sleepy. And so I said to Kevin, and I had been shadowing him and learning from him, I said, Kevin, I really just want to teach. What should I do? He said, you want to teach? There's one place you need to go, the best place in the world. You got to go go learn at Jim McLean Golf School.
So you go to Jim McLean School. And you come out of that, and how do you land at Woodmont?
So I'll keep the story going. So after Sleepy, Vero, Sleepy, and I was an assistant, I was playing a lot of golf, right? Because at Quail Valley, it was not a very big club. So there were only, I think, 9,000 members. When I could just play every single day, the greens were pure. So I played so much golf. That was really a wonderful time. I learned so much. Then I wanted to teach. So then instead of going down to Quail Valley, I went to Jim McLean Golf School in Miami. So to get that job, anybody that teaches at the Jim McLean Golf School, you start as an assistant. It's like a little boot camp, and you're doing menial jobs, but you're also allowed to watch anything. You're only working 4 days a week, but you work open to close, but then you've got 3 days off and you can do whatever you want. So there's 3 days. I would just go back to the golf school with my notebook and just watch. And there were training sessions. It was very, very tightly organized golf school. So that was the most, I would say, accelerated learning I had as an instructor, and being surrounded with 10 other assistants, but 15 other instructors. There's just quite a plus gym. Tour players were there weekly because of all the instructors. Everybody was working with someone that was good. So you're seeing all kinds of people, the range of skill went all the way up to the tour level, like major winner level, and as low as, you know, giving beginner clinics. So you saw the entire range of stuff on that front. And so that's a whole nother kind of, I guess, conversation about what happens at golf schools and how that was influential. But for me, it was a really, really, it was like a really potent sprint. And then there was a year at Sleepy where I'd go up there for the summer, and I got the call from Lauren Anderson from Proponent Group. And he said, and Proponent Group at the time was, I was a member of that. This was originally AMF, Archer Mulcahy Ford. Lauren Anderson was the guy that started the top 100 list at Golf Magazine, and he broke off and then created this group that was for teachers, kind of a networking group for teachers. And I guess the need at the time was for golf courses, and if they're looking to hire teachers, to have a way, like a database of finding the kind of the cream of the crop. Like, how do we get the best teachers in a group now, and so we can pull from them if they need to hire? And so from that sprout this idea, well, why don't we foster a community with these teachers and then create all the things that teachers need in this industry? Because there's all kind of contract type things, social media help, just anything from across the board you can think of, help with designing buildings, help with technology, like mentor to mentor, peer to peer networking. Anyway, so then I got the call, and that was for Chevy Chase Club.
Uh-huh.
So I was the teaching pro at Sleepy, but I wasn't the number one. Kevin Sprecher was the number one as a director of instruction. And this would put me in the number one spot as the teacher. So I took that job. I moved to DC, and that was in 2008.
Oh, wow. I don't think I knew that piece, that you were at Chevy Chase. So how long were you there?
Yeah, I was at Chevy 9, 10, 11, 12. I was at Chevy for 4 years. I was still going down to Florida. So I did Chevy, Jim McLean, Chevy, Jim McLean. And then at that point, I think I did that three more times. And then at that point, I've been doing it 10 years. And I thought, you know what? I'm starting to need another challenge. I do like challenge. And I felt like I was starting to plateau in terms of how much I was benefiting from going down to Florida. It's a big wear and tear on your life and your body to travel for an entire season down to another state. So I thought at the time, I can do better. Why don't I'd like to really learn more. So that's when I decided I would apply to grad school, and took the year to study for the Kaplan so I could take my GRE. This is now 13 years after undergrad, and undergrad, like as a media studies major, I mean, this is a lot of distance between, you even know what foiling is? Like
what is foiling?
going back to learn all these things that I had learned a long time ago, but I just, anyway. So I ended up getting into Columbia Teachers College, which was where I really wanted to go. Very small but powerful program that focuses on the neurological implications and expressions of learning. So it's kind of a mix of neurology, kind of neuroscience, behavioral neuroscience, and psychology. And so the crossroads of that would be this little discipline called motor learning. And motor learning is really just how you learn how to create habits, how you learn how to break them, how do you make them. And this is a big topic in the world of, say, stroke rehabilitation or adaptive movements, or the National Academy of Sciences was hired by the Army back in the 80s to come up with an exhaustive scientific explanation of how people could train faster and better. They ended up publishing all this. I had spent a great deal of time early on learning about learning about the golf swing itself and learning about the physics of a golf club and the physics and the biomechanics of a body, the kinematic sequencing. I've been working with Dr. Neil Robbiel and his wife, Karen Harrison, who are brilliant researchers and movement scientists that were part of the Jim McLean Golf School. And since then, I've stayed really close with them. And Dr. Neil's had so much to contribute to the world of what to do in a golf swing. That's not to say he doesn't talk about how to do it, but Jim McLean certainly didn't talk as much about how to do stuff, how to think about interacting with someone's body if they have habits. I mean, certainly it's not like he was blind to it, but really I wanted to understand the extra piece that I felt like for me was a big blind spot. The extra piece was, okay, I know where this person should be if they want to hit a great golf shot. Like that part I've got. But what should they be doing in their time between now and then when I see them next? Right? And how, yeah, right. If someone really wants to make a change and level up, how do they go about that? Is it better to do it slow, fast, break it up, go on the golf course, do it on the driving range? How do we think about that? And by the way, there's a ton of research, ton of peer-reviewed, good journal article research on some of this, not all of it, but some of it. So it's not like nobody's asked these questions before. Scientists have asked these questions before. And so the conversation of human behavior is not one that just golf pros are asking. I just happen to be one of the rare golf pros that went into the world of science to kind of help find some answers.
So does part of that, like using the kind of the neuroscience behind it and studying motor learning and then applying that to teaching your students, is part of that understanding why they fall back into bad habits? Or is a lot of what you're teaching, like when I think of motor learning, and this is just me off the top of my head, it's not like I've given this a lot of thought, but is the idea of figuring out the way your body should move, like in the golf swing, proper sequencing, and then, you know, repetition to a point where that becomes second nature. I'm sure it's a million times more complicated than that, but am I going in the right direction?
You're definitely in the right ballpark. That is the ballpark. I mean, that is the ballpark, okay. Right? So, and I think most people would say exactly what you just said. It's like, okay, now I know what I need to do. Now I need to go do it a million times, right? So where I was interested in is saying, okay, what does that million times look like? And can we make it 500 times instead of a million? How can we make this so that, because what are we talking about here? We're talking about people that are not, I mean, not necessarily pros, but if you are a pro, this certainly applies to you too. But there are things that we would do slightly differently if you're tour pro. But for the top of the bell curve of people that play golf, which would be 11 handy, 15 hit, 20 handicaps. Actually, you're probably more on the lower handicap side than most people. They're moms and dads with not a lot of time, and who, you know, they want to have fun. They want to play well. Most people just want to get a little bit better. They want to get better, but they're not willing to actually sacrifice everything they do in life to get better. So if that being the case, like if you're not able to put 2 hours a day into practice, what do you have to do? If you are able to put 2 hours a day into practice, and I teach plenty of those people too, mostly they're high schoolers. Okay. Or college players. What do they do? There are other things we might lean in on that, and the whole process can accelerate the more time you have to do it. But if you really need to get there, then that message has to be very clear. And I'm a lot less flexible with how you approach it. If you have to get somewhere, like I'm probably going to give you a harder list of things to do than if you don't really have to get there.
Interesting. So, and you're starting to apply this to, how you teach today, at Woodmont, so are pretty much all of your clients or your students Woodmont members, or do you hold some outside clinics? Do you teach a lot? I mean, I know you're so active in social media and YouTube and with Titleist and all these different areas. Do you do a lot of online teaching, or is it almost all in person?
I don't do any online teaching. None. I don't have time for it. I don't have time. So my hours are, I teach 6 hours of lessons a day. I'll teach a 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and 11 o'clock, and then a 1, a 2, and a 3. And that's the least that I've kept on my schedule in a long time. But it feels like it's right, and it feels like I can kind of manage everything with that. I'll do a lot of videos. I kind of try to squeeze them in when I can, or on an off day. You know, the shoulder season starts to slow down, so I have some pockets of time. But I'm mostly teaching Woodmont members. You know, would my members take priority, of course, but I have some outsiders as well.
Interesting. And so where I was going with this a little bit of understanding who you're teaching is, so we're going back to, you know, your motor learning and how your kind of methodology and how you're teaching. I imagine, you know, especially when it comes to motor learning and how you move your body, teaching a kid who's still kind of learning all that and is still growing into their bodies is much different than some old dude like myself, or even much older, like a retiree who's, the way they move their body is probably not going to change a great deal. I mean, how does that impact what you're doing?
Big, in a huge way. Two totally, totally, totally different approaches. You know, someone who's their central nervous system isn't even developed yet. That is a completely different. And if they're a child, their attention span's different, and their interest level might be different. And so, you know, you're looking at creating hopefully a good habit early on, because those early habits tend to be the strongest. So, you know, there's an element of fun that you have to involve, but there's also an element of like, we got to do this right now, because if you don't do it correctly now, you're going to create a bad habit, and that's going to be a real problem. So I'd almost rather see a kid not play golf. Like, I don't push my daughter. I'd rather her not even do it unless she's going to do it well and then, and be interested in it. So I don't, she has clubs, but she's playing ice hockey and she swims and she does soccer, and like, oh, she can get to golf. It's just a complicated sport, you know, to move and implement, and have to, you know, the requirement is so high. Now for an older person, yeah. I look at it like this. Okay, if you're trying to make a change with something, let's look at the reality here. How much mileage have you put on the existing move? Like, we could use an example of, like, you know, where the club goes at the top of the backswing. If you've been across the line with an open face your entire life, but you manage to kind of pull the club back inside with some reasonable amount of consistency, why are we going to change that? Right. So I have to think really hard and clear and work with that player to really make those choices, because it's a hard thing to make a change if it's like already baked in. Now, that's sure. Not to say you can't change it. It's just, it's harder to change it later on, because you need that many more reps. You need that much more practice. And oftentimes someone who's, you know, retired, their body's not as strong as it was, you know, and they're going to get injured with all this practice. So, you know, I'm a lot less interested in making changes unless someone comes to me and they're like, okay, I have to do this. I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure? Here's what it's going to take. Okay, we'll do it. But, you know, so I'll do light changes, or I'm like, always want to work with what someone has over make changes, because making changes is so expensive in time and in work.
So does this background of yours, having a master's in motor learning, early on when we talked about the top 100 teachers in Golf Magazine, and you said that you knew 36 of them, but you made a comment, you said it seemed like we covered all the different areas of golf teaching, which I thought was interesting. So does your area, like, how do you view your own area of golf teaching? I imagine motor learning is a big piece of it. And do a lot of other PGA pros kind of skip over this aspect of it? Or can you expand a little bit what you meant when you said, you know, all these different pros cover all these different areas of golf teaching?
Yeah, I don't know that I've thought so clearly about this to have a perfect articulate answer. I don't think you need a master's degree to be a good coach at all. In fact, I think I went way overboard with what I did. I don't think that. So I don't want to take anything away from the coaches that are out there. I think that there's a lot of just experience that plays a role. There's a lot of that I think people have done a good job just by teaching for 30 years. You kind of figure things out. You figure out that someone who's 70 is not going to want to make a change. I think maybe what distinguishes my perspective from some others would be that I can say with like great confidence in some of the things that I'll lay out as a framework, and I can back it up. I can back it up very clearly. And my approaches are just very succinct in terms of knowing what pathway someone might need or is able to do. That being said, I don't know. I don't always talk about this so directly with a student. I might just say, here's what you need to do. And if you want to know why, I can talk about it, but I don't think the why might not be that interesting to someone. Like, you just want to know what time it is. You don't want to know how the watch works.
Right, sure.
So I don't know, maybe from experience, like someone might come in and take a lesson and say, well, that was a good lesson, but I don't feel like it was like a heavy in motor learning. It was a good lesson. So I don't really know how to answer that, Alex. Whether I don't know. I mean, I think I do most of my discussions from peer to peer. So I'll talk a bit more about practice and different types of skill development, like to peers. So maybe in that way, I think there are a few of us, like Matt Wilson of Baltusrol. He and I have a lot of similar interests. We talk about this stuff. So there's a few out there.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure you've got tons of different clients, but you did post that you've got everybody's favorite sportscaster was in your studio, SVP, Scott Van Pelt. How was his swing?
Now, his swing's great. And I think he, like every other normal human being who has a job, has you know, tightness in the hips, or there, you know, there's areas that could be worked on, but the guy's really athletic. And it was fun to see. It's fun to see him just kind of put it together. He's a really nice guy. Really nice.
So to someone, one of the reasons I want to bring that up, I'm curious how, obviously you said most of your clients are members, but you're also so active on social media. We talked a little bit before we were recording on all these different platforms. You're very visible, more so than most PGA pros. There's a lot of PGA pros that have really adapted to social media and being online and being out there, but you're among them. Do you acquire a lot of clients that way? Or like, did this, like,
yeah, I have to be real careful because I can't teach just non-members at Woodmont. You know, I'm not at the Trillium Rose Golf Academy on the side of the highway where I could just see anybody. And there are some days where I just wish I could say yes to everybody. I mean, truly, truly, I wonder, you know, I wonder how many fabulous, fabulous people I'm not able to work with because of it. You know, on the flip side, I've got an unbelievable facility, an unbelievable membership, and I've got unbelievable golf course. So if I had, you know, if I had two lives, I would do both.
How is that? Your videos are fantastic. How, if it really doesn't bring in new members, like, how has being so visible online benefited you?
Well, companies want audiences.
Sure.
So you can use your imagination on that front. Right. And I'm, right. I'm pretty careful with what companies I'll endorse or partner with, because I want to like them. I want to like the company and what they do and what they're about. So I found some strategic alliances to be very, very productive, where it's helpful for me to have part of their audience. It's helpful for them to have my audience. And I like what they have to offer. Titleist being one of them, Jalen Burke being another, Arcos for sure. And there are a few others in there that I really think are great. So the number of companies that I would say I've worked with are a few, but they're awesome. I think there's something very satisfying in being able to be available to people. I love reading comments and I love what people have to say. And I learned so much from people's responses to some of these videos. It feels good to know that somebody might have a slightly better shot because they have a good image in their head. So I think for the most part, social media has helped me just reach more people and that feels great. Maybe just some brand recognition, some awareness, so I'll get calls from some random people saying, hey, would you come speak? And I love doing that. And it's fun to show up and have people say, well, they already know what questions they want to ask because they're familiar with kind of what I've said mm-hmm. in the past. And I think that's really kind of fun too.
Well, you do a great job of it. What about Woodmont? Can you tell us so you've been at Woodmont? I always forget how many years you've been at Woodmont? 10 years. And so Woodmont, I think it's as far as like outsiders, it's most well known for hosting the U.S. Open qualifying seemingly every single year. But also, like you mentioned, the
40 years.
Is that 40 years consecutively?
Yeah, I think there's one or two in there where they helped. They did a women's qualifier. But consecutively.
That's crazy. I've been to a few of them. I went this year and saw they had a dramatic 3-person playoff or maybe it was in 4. I can't remember. But it was great time. And the course is looking fantastic with a brand new training area and the par 3 course and all the bunker renovation and everything. The course is looking out of this world. I didn't know about the Adaptive Open coming. That's exciting. You mentioned the USGA Women's Amateur, and I did notice that this fall, I think Georgetown's hosting a tournament there. Is that right?
Yeah. Howard University, we let them come practice. So I volunteer for the Howard team. Their team, anyone's always welcome to come in from Howard and I'll work with them. So that's been really fun.
So the membership is pretty, it seems like they're obviously pro having these outside events. What's kind of the membership's view on hosting all these events?
So we have, if we said yes to every single request, we'd have no tee times. We definitely say no more than we say yes. That's for sure. I'd say we say no most of the time, but we have an outing every Monday. It's very strategic. I mean, to be a member of Woodmont, two of the pages you have to talk about your philanthropic commitments and your involvement. So every single member at Woodmont, it's part of the fabric of being a member at Woodmont is philanthropy. So everybody has their own charity. They have their own thing they put their energy towards. So we have requests weekly, but that's even within our membership of can we do this? Can we do that? Can we do this? So we say yes, but we say no. But we do a lot. We do a lot for groups.
For folks that haven't been out there or haven't played it, what are the main differences between the North and the South course?
Okay. So the South course is just being redone. And now that is being redone, not in a way, not like the 1962 Jaguar convertible TV McDonald, but redone as in this can be cool. We can make this really unusual and fabulous.
So, like a total renovation.
Yeah. Like a total renovation. Oh, cool. So some of these holes are just knock your socks off.
It's closed. The South is closed right now.
So right now they're going through two stages. So stage one is the fairway and rough, but mostly the rough. So the rough is it really needs warm weather. So they're killing it off so they can seed it and get it ready. The cool weather stuff is the green. They'll do the greens in the winter. So like for an example, one of our greens is a horseshoe green and they're flanked by bunkers. There's a hidden bunker in the green. You can't see to the far right. And there's a bunker in the front. So depending on where the flag is, your approach shot would be entirely, it's a short hole. I mean, like 300, like 320. It's a very short hole. But hitting that green is just, it's a lot of fun.
That's cool. And so to the member is the, because it seems like the North is the one that's traditionally hosting all of these events. Is that kind of the stouter test between the two?
I think so. I mean, I think that the North is a lot longer and it's more consistent. So there, you know, it rewards really good shots all the time. The South course, I think, has a little more quirk in terms of length disparity. So you might have a real short and then a really long, and the consistency of the South will be better once we finish it. But the South course is zoysia grass, and zoysia is real squishy. So if you hit a shot off the tee, your ball's not going to roll that much. But I mean, you can hit a 3-wood off that stuff like it's a 7-iron. So it's a kind of a more comfortable, I would say, easier. The greens don't roll as fast. Golf course in the North is much more of a test, especially if you're nervous about hitting off of tight lies, the bent fairway. It's a harder course then.
So as the head pro, when we're talking about the practice, because you guys, there's this brand new kind of practice area that's got, I don't know how many greens, but plus you get this par 3 course. Being the head teaching professional, do you get some say in kind of how some of that was laid out a little bit?
So the par 3 course, that is the loop. That was a idea that David Dorn, the director of golf, had, and he worked with one of our members, Mo, and then the architect, and they came up with that all on their own. And that was off the hook, the best thing I think that Woodmont's seen. And so that not as much, but the short game area where you said we have a couple, yes, we have two greens and we've got several bunkers. So Ryan is the superintendent. I have a conversation with Ryan every time he makes some kind of adjustment to our training areas. And so I've talked to him a lot about the driving range itself and where we put flags. So yeah, the answer is yes. I've got a great communication line with our superintendent and David Dorn, director of golf. So if we make changes, I'm always asked to weigh in from a teaching perspective.
Very cool. Well, listen, this has been fantastic. I know you got to run. You've got a busy day, I'm sure. This has been great. I really appreciate you coming on. I think it's really appropriate. We didn't even get a chance to really talk about Solheim, which is this week. I think it's very appropriate having one of the premier female golf instructors in the country who happens to be right here in our backyard in the DMV on the show the week of the Solheim Cup. So hopefully I'm going to publish this before the weekend. But thank you very much, Trillium. And I also didn't even get a chance to ask you about your name, which is one of the great names. Because Rose is that your married last name?
My married name. So Trillium's a flower. And I was born in Vermont in the month of May. May is when the flowers in bloom. I didn't have a name from the hospital. My dad said, let's just name her the first flower we see. Let's walk out in the woods and voila, there's a Trillium. So that's all.
That's fantastic. Hello. That is very cool. All right. I'll let you go. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. This has been great.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about DC golf.